What makes these Western stories?
I think because I'm so rooted in this place and I feel that I write very much out of this place. And I can't really imagine these stories in any other place. I think that's one of the reasons they're Western stories.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Carolyn Patterson about her collection of stories, Ballet at the Moose Lodge. We'll jump back into her compelling answer about what makes the Western experience different for men and women and why that matters in the literary tradition. This program contains adult language and themes. Listener discretion is advised.
I think that the West is not just a destination, as many people think it is. I think that the West is a really complex place to live. And I think one of the things that really interests me in writing about women living in the West is that the West, I think for so many of the men that I grew up reading, which pretty much defined as history when I was growing up, it was always about a place of escape, or it was a place of redefinition. And it's a very different thing, I think, for most women, especially the women I grew up knowing. You know, it could be a place of experiencing freedom, but for many women I knew, the West was often also a place of being trapped, and it was a place of feeling isolated. It was also a place of frustration and despair, and then trying to feel your way out of those things, or feel your way not being trapped by those things, and also being surrounded by people saying, but you're living in a place with so much freedom, when those women are not feeling that at all. To me, that's the particular dilemma of women living in the West, and maybe particularly women living in decades earlier, but maybe not in maybe our generation as well.
What I was wondering is, do you think that's changed over time? Do you think women have more freedom now in the West?
Perhaps. But I think as social roles are beginning to change, maybe perhaps as particularly, I think, with caretaking and child rearing, just supporting a family, if that's part of the equation in a woman's life, or even the choice to have a family, or right. I think so many of those roles are changing. So I think that is changing some, but not maybe as much as we think it might be.
Sure. Can you tell me about some of the roles that you've had as a Western woman?
Yeah, I've been, writer. I've worked as a secretary. I've worked as a salmon egg packer. I've been a mother, and I've felt very isolated. But I've also had, I've worked as an editor, magazine editor. I've been a wife. I've been a sister and a daughter. And so I think a number of those roles that are sort of traditional roles and then maybe not such traditional roles. I've been a travel writer. Mm-hmm. I think I started out feeling like a very non-traditional woman. And once I had kids, I felt much more tied to the more traditional women in my past. Mm-hmm. Which was nice, actually. I mean, I've always felt like I wrote about them and I was connected to them in stories, but I wasn't as connected to them in my life until I had children. And you then feel more connected to maybe their frustrations and their stories.
I want to come back around to the strong female characters in your work, but I want to just sort of meditate on the dudes that you have in your book. There's some bad dudes, some scary ones, and there's also some benign men. Where did you come across this concept of gray man?
I don't know, actually. It's interesting, that story I wrote after I had gone to Europe. My brother got married in Europe, and I read Jung's autobiography. Mm-hmm. I had a 20-hour train ride, and so I spent most of that train ride reading that. And I don't know if it was what came out of that book, but when I got home from that trip, I wrote that story in a day. It was after there had been a fire on Mount Sentinel, which was kind of the only actual part of that story. I don't really know where that story came from.
Well, this is fascinating because we're having a Jungian moment right now. This is Carl Jung, right? Is it Memories, Reflections, Dreams?
Yes.
Okay. I learned about Gray Man from my brother writing the London Underground. So I was in Europe, too, when I heard this concept.
Huh.
So it's sort of strange. But the notion is that a person can sort of slip into the background and maybe get away with things because they go unnoticed, essentially, right?
Right.
Because they're sort of just a nobody in how they look and how they act, which takes us to this story that you've written called Backfires. Will you read us a little bit about it?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm one of the gray men, the men who fix things, sell things, break things, and you never notice. We move in and out of your towns, drink at your bars, sleep at your motels, eat your food, fuck your women, and you never see us. We live at the edges of things, but close enough so you can't see our faces real clear. I worked at some job fixing small engines, and I kept to myself. It was a medium shop, 20 men, and they were always organizing picnics, softball teams, football pools. I went to one or two so they wouldn't notice I wasn't at the rest. I met her at the picnic up Wild Horse Canyon. I was standing near a group of people at the bonfire. They were roasting hot dogs, and the kids were burning up marshmallows on willow sticks and sticking the goo in their mouths. I was watching the fire, I believe in fire, when I looked over and saw her, a blonde woman about up to my shoulders, her hair curling away from her face, and even though it was July, she was more pink than brown in her blue striped shorts. Everyone was telling dirty jokes and laughing in a beer-soaked way, but she didn't. She didn't say anything. She just stood by that ass Tom Dobbins and picked the meat off a chicken breast strip by strip. Now you'll think, here's this guy staring like a baboon, but you're playing me cheap. For as soon as I saw her, I had her memorized, and the rest I discovered as soon as I stood there, sipping my beer, just watching the fire. If you listen, you can discover a lot. Now, I don't usually have much to do with women. Not real women. Women are fire. Men are their kindling. I know this. I look at men, men I work with, men on the streets, and I can tell which ones have been consumed. I look at them from far away, nothing but charred trunks with legs, and I feel sorry. Wives burn husbands, mothers burn sons, sisters burn brothers. I tried to stay away from the girl. But one night, as I was driving to the Quick Mart for beer, I saw her. She was driving a blue Mustang with a dent in the back, and she drove by me, plain as day, her windows down, her hair blowing back, yellow and shiny. This time she had glasses on, and I didn't like that, but in the husky night she looked cool. I pulled a U-turn and followed her. I followed her to the mall, always keeping in mind a good distance, and I followed her home.
There's this line from Backfires, and I want to know what you mean by it. Women are fire, men are their kindling.
I think there's a logic to a character like this that is, I think when you're trying to work with a character like this that's really lives in his own kind of world of insanity, I was trying to work from the fire first, and then what is the logic behind someone like this? And I think that's what you always, there is a crazy logic to someone who's like this, I think. Mm-hmm. I felt like there had to be a woman involved somehow. I felt like the fire had to come from that somehow. And I felt like he had some deep-seated fear of women, that women were all consuming and that they consumed men, that they were kind of out to get him. And that was, in a weird way, what drove him to light this backfire.
What's it like for you to write from the male versus the female perspective?
I think more than it being really difficult writing from a man's point of view, it was really interesting to, for me to look at the town from an alien point of view. And I think that's part of why this story was really interesting for me to write. It was at a point where I think I had been living here for a while and I felt like I needed to see it in a whole different way. And I think that was going back to what you're saying about a gray man. I wanted to see it in a way, an alien way. And I think that also was part of trying to look at it from a different gender as well.
Right. And when you say town, you mean you're referring to Missoula, Montana?
Yeah.
The town that you grew up in.
Yeah. And I think that's hard when you write about some place that you live. You're always trying to get some kind of distance from it. So whether that's writing about the past or using different point of view or writing about characters who are different than you are or writing even in a different gender, that's part of that distance I think you need.
Your work has been called unflinching, and you take on some pretty tough subjects in this book, including teen pregnancy, child molestation, and eating disorders. Where does this courage come from in you?
I try to look at the light stuff. I was just joking. Well, I think I've personally had to look at some hard things in my own life. And I guess it's the material that interests me. I come from a family that had to deal with some really dark things and didn't always deal with them in a really straightforward way. One of the reasons writing appealed to me so much was that the honesty of writers was so clarifying to me. Here was a place where you could really say what you thought, or where people said what they thought. It was like an astringent. It was bracing and not always comfortable, but it was so clarifying because people observed things that they really felt were going on and not the polite version of things that were going on.
Do you have a sense then of why you turned to fiction? Because you could have turned to just straight nonfiction. I know you've written nonfiction in your time, but why fiction and why the short story?
I like fiction because I like the latitude of fiction. I don't think my own stories in and of themselves would be particularly great memoir. I like being able to use them as a starting off point, but not an ending point. I start out in music, and I think I have a real musical sense of the story as a shape. I was a pianist and I played a lot of sonatas, and they kind of have a shape like a sonata, you know, with an opening and a like a middle section and a conclusion. I love short stories. I love the shape of them. I like development of them. I like the intensity of them. And I think probably more than the novel, which I'm still trying to write well, I think I have more of an organic sense of their shape.
So in thinking about the book as a whole, what kind of body of music does it resemble most closely? I mean, there are four sections, four movements.
Well, that would be like a sonata, actually. Wow, I hadn't ever thought of that. A quartet, maybe?
Yeah. What instruments would you want to hear if you could turn your book into a musical piece?
Wow. Probably piano, violin, definitely cello, probably a bass somewhere there. Maybe some horns. Maybe we're talking a symphony, I don't know.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Carolyn Patterson about her collection of short stories, Ballet at the Moose Lodge. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the second half, Carolyn and I will discuss her instinct to write toward tough subjects. Given the adult nature of this discussion, listener discretion is advised. How do you temper the tough subjects to make them readable?
I really like humor. I like to use as much humor as I can. And I think just grounding them in a place and in personalities and in things that are interesting to me, whether it's the way a house looked or what somebody cooked for dinner or some of the quotidian details of somebody's life, and also how people survived things like that, difficult things. I think it's really important as a fiction writer that you do temper really difficult things with things that aren't so difficult. And it was interesting. I just taught a writing workshop, and this young writer came up with an idea that was really wonderful, but she started right at the end of the story, and I knew that was something I would have done, and she was completely stuck because you start at the saddest part of the story, and I think that's something you tend to do as a young writer. You gravitate toward really serious, like young poets always want to write about death, which is the thing they know the least about. As you get closer to those serious subjects like suicide or a child's death or something, the more gingerly you want to take those subjects on, or the more delicately you feel that you need to handle them, you feel the weight of what you're really taking on a lot more, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Sort of the hinge of the book is a story called Bridge Night, a fairy tale. And the first line is, "Who, she thought, would kiss her awake?" And that fairy tale turns quite dark and resurfaces, maybe with a rescue or an imagined rescue. But I am thinking about both the turn that you take from what you just said was sort of like not starting at the most painful point, you know, stepping back a little bit, getting into the pain, finding conclusion. But I'm thinking a lot about sexuality in your work because that's a huge theme. That's a melody I've seen in your work. Mm-hmm. Also in the short story that's included in Montana Noir. Mm-hmm. What do you know about your instinct to go to like teen sexuality or blossoming sense of sexuality or sexuality when it's darker?
I think that I grew up in a really sexually confusing time. And it's just something that I've really wanted to explore fictionally because I just have a lot of questions about it. Personally, I grew up in a time when we were sort of on the verge of the 50s. Maybe our mothers had had sex before marriage, but maybe not. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, it was the 60s and 70s, and everybody was having sex. I've really thought a lot about this. There were a lot of abuses associated with that, and there was a lot of sexual abuse mm-hmm. going on in families, which is something I write about, mm-hmm. which happened to me personally. But then it was not talked about. But then you were also supposed to be liberated sexually, but you weren't liberated sexually. Right. It was so confusing. Then we were young women trying to work, and all the people we were working with pretty much were men. There was sexual abuse in the working place. It's just rampant. Sexual negotiations, having sex, coming of age. Mm-hmm. It was really uncharted. All of that stuff was scary and clunky and fictionally fascinating to me. I write about that a lot. It was also really scarring, especially in light of all of the material, everything that's coming out now. I mean, I've written about this in nonfiction as well. What would our world have been like if these abuses didn't happen? What would we be like as women mm-hmm. if this had not happened? Or if we came up as young women working, if we had lots of women bosses and so on. I mean, that's what so much of the sexual abuse was about, power. Mm-hmm. I do write a lot about sexual politics, I guess,
yeah,
because they interest me.
Reading your book, there were so many places when I felt finally like the hermetic seal had been broken and like I could breathe again because someone else knew what it was like to be a woman and wasn't afraid to say it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. One of the other patterns that I also read into your work, probably, so I'd like you to tell me how intentional it was, but there are moments when I felt like even though the stories were different and the characters were different, it was almost like you could weave a thread from one story to the next, even though they might be separated by 100 pages. But in the case of the fairy tale story, the story that follows right after is called Good Bones, and it's about, you know, an adolescent girl who starts dieting, you know, maybe with, quote unquote, the best of intentions, and ends up headlong, I think, in an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I thought, yes, as one would do after an experience where mm-hmm. their body was taken over by someone else. Mm-hmm. Was that intentional in terms of placement in the book?
I had a group of stories that I had together that were kind of intentional. And actually, it wasn't that story. It's funny, it wasn't really that story. It was that story and the story that was in the Montana Noir book. Those two were together mm-hmm. initially, and then I couldn't, because of copyright and everything, I couldn't put that in this book. So those were the two that I had imagined being together. Mm-hmm. So one was kind of a coming-of-age story, and the other was the story, basically, of this sexual abuse by a family friend. But I hadn't thought of the starvation story being the third part of it, but of course that makes sense. I've read a lot of Alice Munro, and she writes often of a character who's very similar, especially in her earlier works, not so much her later works, but who's similar. And I'm not comparing myself to her. I only could dream to be even an iota as talented as she is. But I think I've done that in some ways. Some characters, some are not similar, but some
right.
are.
Which, I mean, maybe that's what I could say, is that there is a world that you create with this book. You know, even though there are many stories here, the world feels real and feels livable, and it carries through the whole thing, which is, I think, a comfort to a reader. It's like,
great.
We can live, yeah. we can, you know, there's this place.
Right.
That is, you know, it's being created and created and created over again, even though the circumstances change, you know, the names change, even the point in history changes.
Uh-huh.
Will you read us a little bit from Good Bones?
Sure. The next day, Emily ate a fried egg and toast, her last regular meal, and walked ceremoniously downtown to the cool dark of Woolworths to buy a diet book. She passed up the lunch counter, empty except for a few early shoppers, clutching rattling sacks and drinking coffee, past the candy counter piled with dry-looking fudge. She lingered at the eyeshadows for a while, then shook herself back to her purpose, laid out a quarter for a Dell diet book, a new and thinner you, and went home, resolute. She calculated lists of numbers, calories used, calories needed, calories she would from now on consume. She found these additions and subtractions comforting, clean, like a blueprint for a giant machine. She did not cheat on portions. She was as mean to herself as possible, which gave her a stinging kind of satisfaction. Soon she had great lists of numbers, a sample menu, and then it was time for lunch, and she resolutely faced 245 calories of applesauce and cottage cheese. By the end of June, she had lost 6 pounds. She felt sleek and strong. She had taken herself in hand. She was hungry all the time. Emily didn't like tennis, and swimming turned her hair green, so she settled on running and exercises. 30 sit-ups, push-ups, side kicks, jumping jacks, and her favorite, humiliating leg lifts called fire hydrants. The routine did not vary for 5 months. Each night, she put on her tennis shoes, checked her watch, and ran for 20, maybe 25 minutes, pushing herself until it hurt and beyond, pushing herself until she imagined she could feel a bonfire of calories raging in her stomach, lighting her ribs, her body fooled and turning on itself for food.
What advice do you have for women who are as mean to themselves as possible?
To stop it and be nice to yourself. Having struggled with eating disorders and so on. And actually, I watched my daughter struggle with this just a little bit. I think now, oh, really? Why? You know, for what reason? We're so hard on ourselves. What is in our heads that we're moving toward, that we're trying to push towards so hard? It's everything that our culture has really put there. What's the point? So we can look like somebody in a magazine that isn't who we are. Or, you know, it's so much energy. It's so much energy. And I always think of that beautiful Mary Oliver phrase about, you know, what are you going to do with your one wild and beautiful life? Mm-hmm. Go on a diet?
Right. That there are billion-dollar industries that are fueled by women hating themselves.
Yeah.
And to speak to your earlier point, which is, my golly, what could we be doing if we weren't thinking about our cellulite?
Yeah.
We could change the world.
Yeah. I just, exactly. And, you know, for me, I was so obsessed by that in high school. For me, it had to do with figuring out what I really wanted to do and letting whatever was inside myself, figuring that out. And once I was able to do that, all that stuff didn't really matter anymore. That's really more the key to something like that than diets or any of that stuff. It just caring about something outside of yourself. I don't pretend to know the answer for other people, but I agree. If you could take all of the energy that it takes to do that stuff and just put it toward something else.
Mm-hmm. One of your characters is a real estate agent, and you write that she thinks, the dream of starting over, that's what I sell. So, Carolyn Patterson, as the director of the Missoula Writing Collaborative, what is it that you sell?
Ooh. Do I sell? Well, I don't think of myself as selling anything.
What do you offer?
I'd like to think we offer kids a chance to find their voice. And I think I do feel really passionate about that because I think, like we just discussed, for me, it was really what saved my life. It saved me from being obsessive, or it turned my obsession into a different direction, maybe. I started working for the Writing Collaborative in the classroom. And actually, I started teaching for them in Helena at kind of a hard time in my life. It was so wonderful to see how transforming learning to write a poem about their lives could be for young kids. It was just joyful. It was so exciting. That's what made me such a believer in this process. The writers that teach for us find this every day. You know, whether or not these kids go on to become writers, probably a lot of them won't, but at least they'll have that ability to shape words. They'll understand the power and possibility of language, and they'll have had that experience of learning how to make something, how to write, and understand how you can take a raw experience and shape it into something beautiful.
Patterson lives in Missoula, Montana, where she's the executive director of the Missoula Writing Collaborative. Look for more information about her book and the collaborative at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.